I want to offer a new perspective on the coming of the American Civil War. Most of us, when we think about the Civil War, think about this terrible American tragedy as a family quarrel. It broke up families. And of course, the other way to think about the Civil War is to think about that great American tragedy of slavery. And it was a cancer that needed to be cut out of the body politic so that the promise of America could be redeemed. Now, that's a good story, too, and I believe it. But what I want to suggest tonight is that there's another way to think about the Civil War that might have some meaning to us today when we think about America and the world. We are the only superpower. And we're thinking a lot about what it means to be the dominant power in the world and what responsibilities that might entail. What's the world like anyway out there, and how do we make sense of it? Those same sorts of questions were very compelling to early Americans, notwithstanding the fact that we forget that they were concerned about their place in the world. You get that formulation? We think they were absorbed with the problems that we read back into their time. For instance, the central problem of slavery. Now, I don't want to tell you that slavery is not important, but I do want to tell you that the struggles that pitted North against South were not primarily or originally about slavery. They were debates about the nature of the world. And you say, well, what does that mean? I mean the Atlantic state system, the Atlantic trading system. In other words, Northerners and Southerners, when they debated about the tariff, they're debating about what is the nature of the world system. How does it operate? What they're debating about is whether the world is naturally a peaceful place. Is the world naturally peaceful? Well, who says it's peaceful? In the 19th century, it's students of the classical economists, that is, the great liberal economists, Adam Smith, David Ricardo, and the other inventors of the modern discipline of economics. It's hard to think of the inventors of the dismal science, as it's fondly known, as being progressive cosmopolitans. But they were. They had a vision that through the international division of labor, we could guarantee peace and prosperity. Now, this is going to sound awfully familiar to you because the arguments made by free traders, people who wanted a low protective, or rather a revenue tariff, no protective tariff, the arguments made by free traders are very much like the arguments made by free traders now. On the other side, we have the protectionists, people who want a high protective tariff. What is their vision of the world? They think the world is naturally a dangerous, anarchic place. They're very much like modern realists in international relations theory, realists who think that every state has a moral obligation to prepare for the next war, because war is the natural state of the world. Now, those are pretty big differences between the notion that peace is the normal or the imminent condition of the world versus the idea that the world is in a state of perpetual war. But between those two positions, we have the great debate over the nature of the American Union. And it's that debate that I'm going to tell you about tonight. Let's start with a view of the world in 1815. This is a good time. We can think of this as the end of a 50-year American Revolution. I was just telling some of my colleagues earlier today that I think periodization is so crucial in the way we interpret history, because the way we define periods implies or requires an interpretation. And if I told you that the Revolution took place from 1765 to 1815, that puts an entirely different spin on things. Now, how can I make such a claim? Well, I'll say it simply, that the American Revolution is only one theater in a larger war throughout the Atlantic system. Indeed, it goes into Asia as well. A world war, if you will. American independence is a consequence of a transformation of the European system in the 18th century. In 1815, if you were an American, you'd be thinking, when is the next war going to take place? You'd ask this question because you, if you'd been alive for the previous 40 years, would have experienced war virtually that entire time, if not hot war, cold war, the threat of war. How could you know that the next 100 years would be a century of free security for the United States, as international foreign policy historians call it? In other words, isolation. Americans don't have any problems. We can go on and fulfill our manifest destiny now. We know that because we write the stories backwards. You can fulfill your manifest destiny. You can take some time off to slaughter each other during the Civil War. That's regrettable, but 600,000 guys, that's, you know, it's population control, and they're bound to be up to no good anyway. I don't mean to trivialize it. That's the way the story can be told, because we know what our subjects don't know. We know that there will be no further threat from abroad. In fact, quite the contrary, the rest of the world is going to be threatened by America over the next century. That is, the rest of the Western world, as the United States spreads across the North American continent, does all the nasty things that makes us leftists very unhappy. So the point I want to start with is that from the perspective of the people I want to talk about tonight, the big question in 1815 is, when is the next war and how do we get ready for it? It's as a result of Americans' performance in the War of 1812, the war effort had been a pathetic embarrassment. And there was a group of people who became known as National Republicans who said, you know, we can't continue down the Jeffersonian path, notwithstanding the great victory of our founding father, Thomas Jefferson, in his inauguration in 1801. The Jeffersonian decentralization, the absence of a strong central government, the absence of a national bank, these were all potential disasters. That's why the war effort was administratively so pathetic. There are lots of other reasons of why the battlefield war was so bad. So these National Republicans wanted to change things. They wanted to prepare for the next war. So that's the setup here. As we talk about the coming of the Civil War, it's in the context of the experience of war. And I earlier told you about free traders and protectionists and their big division about the nature of the world. Well, in effect, the people, the realists, as they called them, the protectionists, the people who wanted to protect American manufacturers so that we could develop a strong, independent national economy to be ready for the next war, these people were sensible people on the face of it. They were, as I say, realists. The people who need to be explained are the free traders. That is, the people who could imagine that peace and prosperity were imminent, notwithstanding the experience of the previous half century or more. There's a lot of learned debate in the 1820s and 1830s about exactly how often has the United States been at war. What percentage of the time have we been at war? Or people are willing to go back to the Peace of Westphalia in 1648 and say, you know, on average, every second year in the Western state system has been a year of war. And if you were prudent, you'd be preparing for war, wouldn't you? But to put this in perspective, why do the free traders believe what they believe? You know who these free traders are? These free traders, they are the liberals of the period. They're the cosmopolitans. They're the progressives. They're the good guys. They're the guys who carry the torch for the American Revolution, for the Enlightenment, because that's what the Revolution had promised, peace and prosperity, a new Republican millennium, no more war. Why were there wars under the ancient regime? It was because of mercantilism. It was because the priestcraft and aristocracy and monarchy, the old world, old Europe. But here in the new world, we'd banish all those institutions of despotism and we'd have a new regime. And so the free traders are really speaking from and to this conception of American exceptionalism, of American difference, of how the American Revolution was an epical revolutionary moment in world history. They sustained that faith in the face of all those wars I've been talking about. But what I wanted to point out, lest there be any misunderstanding, is that these despicable characters are slaveholders. And I hate them. I mean, I feel very strongly about this. And I think it's a wonderful irony. I know the idea that liberals are proponents of minimal government is somewhat mind-boggling, because liberals now are pinkos like me, social welfare types. The words have been transposed. The Republicans, of course, coming into the time of the Civil War, that's the party, or the Whigs previously, that's the party of big government, the activist state. What happened to the Republicans? Well, as I've been saying all day, bemoaning the fact the South really won the Civil War, and to prove it, the South went Republican, and the Republicans went South. What I want to talk about is the crisis of the Union. In fact, I think the whole history of the United States during the period leading up to the Civil War is one series of crises of the Union, but we don't usually think about the grand narrative of American history in this way. Oh, it's one chapter in the textbook, sectionalism. You know, there was a fire bell in the night, there was a Missouri controversy, poor Jefferson lost some sleep, and they were going to try to keep Missouri out of the Union. Awful, awful thing. And just because they wanted to have slaves, well, it's a free country, isn't it? And they wanted to have slaves, but these nasty Northerners, these Yankees, these neo-federalist creeps wanted to keep them out of the Union and deny them that basic Republican right to determine their own domestic institutions. And what could be more central, more crucially important to the Republican character of a regime than its ability to decide on these fundamental questions for itself, to write its own constitution, to have slaves if it wants to? What I want to suggest here, this is my first big point. And the first big point is this. The federal constitution did not create a strong national government. The federal constitution was a peace plan for the American state republics. A peace plan. By that I mean the founders had a task before them, a major challenge, and it was this. They wanted to avoid, on one hand, the specter of universal monarchy, the idea of a consolidated despotic regime, all power centered in one place, because that's, after all, what they had rejected when they left the British Empire. That's how they imagined the British Empire was, a consolidated centralizing regime, the tyranny of George III. Of course, this is nonsense, but it was the rallying cry for patriots in 1775. On the other hand, they want to avoid the extreme of anarchy, because if you don't have a union of some sort, they will all become petty sovereignties, and the result will be a war of all against all. And what would be the result of this? America would become the image of Europe. So you had two things you had to provide against: external threats from Europe. Therefore, you had to create a strong enough government, a kind of league or alliance of American states with enough centralized authority to meet those threats. And then two, you had to provide against internal threats. That is, the possibility that the system would fall apart. It's sustaining this balance is crucial to the future of the Union. That's what the federal constitution is all about. You can't understand the rest of the story unless you understand that. In other words, that the whole beginning of this experiment, this Republican experiment, it's an experiment in international politics. It's a kind of United Nations of America to create a system in which the states would no longer present a threat to each other. They would be disarmed. States would not have standing armies. Security would be collectivized. There would be a federal military and naval presence. But this was not in order to destroy the states, notwithstanding Alexander Hamilton's best hopes. You couldn't have a British-style government in America. It wouldn't work. And Hamilton was outvoted. And the Americans would not have ratified the federal constitution had it destroyed the states. It didn't destroy the states. In fact, the states ultimately destroyed each other. That's the whole story I'm telling you. The states did not go away. So as I've indicated to you, the point of the Constitution was to avoid wars among the states, to avoid or preempt divisions within the states. The Article 4, Section 3, the Guarantee Clause, says that there will be Republican governments in all the states, which means that not only is security collectivized with respect to foreign enemies, but as in all the great peace plans in European history, the security of each member state is guaranteed against internal revolt. And what does that mean in the South? Of course it means slave insurrection. That's the whole point of the Guarantee Clause. Finally, as I've suggested, the Constitution would protect the states against counter-revolutionary European intervention. It's the fear or the specter of Europeanization. The whole point of the new American system is not to be Europe, but it's, you think of then the American experiment in terms of this opposition, Europe and America. And why is it so important not to be Europe? Because the tendencies are toward being European. Not only toward being European, because after all, these are Europeans in America, but because America is intimately involved in the European political and economic system. In fact, the colonies would never have existed in the first place. There'd be no United States of America if they weren't serving some function in the European economic and political system. People just didn't come to America because the air was free and because there was elbow room and because they said, yeah, we could build a great country here. They came here to exploit slaves, to produce products that had markets in Europe. That simplifies it a little. It's an extension of Europe, all right? So how could you possibly have a system that's going to be separate from Europe, since its very existence depends on Europe? And Thomas Paine in Common Sense in 1776 tells us that we're going to be able to take apart the mercantile systems of Europe. As long as eating is the habit in Europe, they're going to need us. In other words, Paine doesn't say, America, we're isolated, we're all by ourselves here, we're going to take care of ourselves. No, he says, we're going to feed Europe and they're going to pay for it. And we are going to dominate and set the tone for the world system because we have vital goods that they need. He was wrong. It was an exaggerated conception of America's economic and therefore political power, but it is eloquent testimony to the fact that America is in Europe, in the system, the European system. And that explains all of these problems for the next 40 years, why the Americans can't escape the European wars, why they're drawn into them, because America is in Europe already. Now, if the Constitution had failed, and believe me, this is another thing that's very hard for people to get straight, that is, they think it had to succeed, didn't it? Because these mighty 55 men, that they effected this great miracle. In fact, the very language of miracle is a giveaway here. People like Madison were convinced, they were desperate, they were afraid that the system would fall apart. And ratification was such a near thing. After all, the Congress under the Confederation barely existed in the last few years before the establishment of the federal government. The tendencies, in other words, were centrifugal, away from union, toward disunion. Now, nobody thought we'd have 13 independent sovereignties. We're forming a more perfect union, guys. Get it? All right. Well, nobody thought you'd have 13 separate sovereignties. What they thought instead is, when push came to shove or crunch time came, you'd end up with three or four. You've got to keep in mind contingency. That's the big C word historians are always saying. Different things could happen. It didn't have to happen. There's no predetermination. God did not say, United States, yeah, I like that concept. I see from sea to shining sea is just about right. Well, God did not say this country had to go from sea to shining sea. Didn't say it had to exist at all. It just happened that way, didn't it? For a lot of contingent reasons. The Constitution did not have to be ratified. And once ratified, the Union did not have to survive. After all, you know why Thomas Jefferson was elected in 1801? It's because of the Three-Fifths Clause, part of the Constitutional Compromise. Three-Fifths Clause, you know what I'm talking about? Every five slaves in the South, that's property, folks, will count for three voters. And that gives them the edge. And if it hadn't been for the Three-Fifths Clause, it would be John Adams's revolution of 1800. Only it wouldn't have been a revolution because it would have been a re-election. And if it had been John Adams's revolution of 1800, then what would Virginia have done? Well, of course, Virginia and Kentucky in 1798 had talked about how they would nullify federal law, the Alien and Sedition Acts. Maybe, that's the N word, nullification, maybe if the Republicans don't get their way in 1800, they will walk. Union falls apart. Jefferson once, in an interesting slip of the tongue, I mean a slip of the pen, wrote referring to the forthcoming election, a forthcoming election, referred to the Southern Party. Oh, sorry, I didn't mean that. Republican Party. Same difference. I mean, it's a bunch of slaveholding planters plus their artisan friends in northern cities, and everybody hates the Federalists. And happily for the Republicans, the Federalists made lots of people hate them, like Baptists and all these dissenters in New England. So actually, Republicans did very well outside of the slaveholding South, but that was their base, and everybody knew it. It's the party of the slaveholders. The Constitution was two things, and this is important to set up. The point I want to make about the Constitution is twofold. First, the Constitution is a peace plan for states, but it is simultaneously a peace plan for sections. The Constitution is nothing more than a bundle of intersectional compromises. Read it someday. I defy you. That's why we love to read the Declaration of Independence. At least the parts that stayed in the final edited version are pretty good reading. The Constitution, no. The best part is we the people, and it's downhill from there. The compromises in the federal Constitution, which enable the sections to coexist, in fact, sustain sectionalism in America. They sustain it. And that's because of the nature of federal politics, which encourages block voting around fundamental economic interests. And those are regional. And remember, to complete our picture, think of the Union as this fragile balance between the forces of anarchy on the one hand, consolidation on the other. So it's a very delicate balance that has to be maintained. It's a balance that's predicated on these compromises and guarantees for states and sections. And as I've said, periodically, American history, the American system is riven by sectional crisis, which is the one in the early 1830s, culminating in the nullification crisis, in which South Carolina uses the N-word and threatens to secede from the Union. Okay, so that's the big picture. It's a gloomy one. American history is the history of a fragile Union in the larger context of international insecurity. And the big question mark looming over the world and looming over the Union is, will there be another war?